So what have you been up to this week?
Well, I've just been to see Faith Healer at Lyric Hammersmith.
Brian Friel. I've never seen it.
You've never seen it. I think it's my favourite Brian Friel.
Is it?
It seems, I'm just writing my review now, and it seems so simple.
Right.
It's four monologues, three people. So fantastic Frank Hardy, the Faith Healer of the title, does the first and the last monologue. And then there's a monologue from his wife and a monologue from his manager. And in each of the monologues, certain events are recounted in exactly the same language. And in each of the monologues, other events are remembered entirely differently. And from the whole four, you get this picture of something that happens, but also a sort of study of obviously memory, of faith and doubt, of faith healing, of love, love and doubt, bereavement. I think it's one of the great plays. And oddly, it's one of the plays that I can't quite forget the first time I saw it. I mean, some plays, I think you kind of overlay with other productions. But yeah, this one, the first person I ever saw do it was Donal McCann, the great Irish actor who I didn't see much on stage because he was sort of coming to the end. And it was in 1992 at the Royal Court, and Sinead Cusack and Ron Cook were the other two.
I always get it confused with Translations because there's a similar monologue.
No, yeah, Translations is more of a play. He does use the monologue form, but it's just, I think it's one of the great plays.
Which is the one that he has? Is it the one with there's a soldier and then somebody talks in a different language?
Well, that is Translations, but that is a play. I mean, that's much more that it just kind of unfolds.
Okay.
This is, pure monologue, really. And, it's grand.
But you loved it.
It's so good. I just, it's like one. It's like Hamlet. I feel that you want to go on and on collecting performances. And this was Justin Mitchell as Grace. And
she's beautiful.
Lovely. And yeah. Nick Holder as Teddy and Declan Conlon.
Nick Holder. These are all brilliant actors. Declan
Conlon is Frank.
I did As You Like It with him in 2000 at the end, and he played Jacques. Brilliant. Brilliant.
Brilliant company.
So we should say welcome to this week's episode of As the Actress Said to the Critic with me, Nancy Carroll, the actress.
And me, Sarah Crompton, the critic.
We're mixing it up. We're doing the other way around.
I know. I have to say goodbye now. So Declan Conlon, you work with at the RSC.
Yeah, As You Like It. Many years ago. Yeah, he's brilliant. So you loved it.
I did. I it's really interesting. And it brings out different shades of it, which is, exactly what you want in watching a drama repeatedly. You want to see different things. You always see different things.
Yeah.
So, it was great. Quite straightforwardly great.
And who directed it?
Rachel O'Riordan.
Oh, great. Oh, brilliant. Exciting.
So very, very good. So what have you been up to this week?
Various things. But we did go, Joe and I went on Sunday to the RST at Stratford-upon-Avon to say goodbye and hello. So say goodbye to Greg Doran as the artistic director of the RST and hello to Dan Evans and Tamara Harvey directors of the RST. It was incredibly moving, actually. I mean, I sobbed through most of the performance. It was a tribute performance, so it was a lot of looking back at productions. A lot of people performed, people made speeches. There were people that had filmed, their tributes and that were part of the performance that they showed on the screen. There was music played, there was a bit of singing. Dan and Tamara made a speech at the beginning and Greg made a speech at the end. I think as you get older, sort of beginnings and ends are incredibly moving and life moving on, the moving on of life, the moving on of time. It sounds simple to say, but it always makes me weep, I think, because you feel grateful for being here and then you, of course, are reminded of people who aren't. And
which would be quite acute at the RST because of Greg had been with Anthony Scher all that time.
Yeah,
when
so there was a
there.
Big thing at the end about Tony Scher, and they had a sort of medley of his performances, and then Greg came on shortly after that and made a speech. And the nature of his speech was gorgeous because he's been there for so long, and he talked about meeting Tony there in 1987 and being an actor there and then becoming a director and then becoming an associate director and then eventually artistic director. So it's his life. It's the central chunk of his life. And actually what was rather beautiful is he decided, you know, he talked about how difficult it was to make a speech and knowing that it would be coming after all these extraordinary tributes and speeches and performances, and he decided to break it down into the highs and lows.
Right.
And how often highs come from lows.
Right.
Or lows come out of the attempt to achieve a high. So he talked about various things about, you know, taking plays to South Africa and situations that have occurred. He talked about this. They had the opening night of Julius Caesar in Russia, and one of the audience members being stabbed.
No.
Yeah, they had this.
I know,
but it was very shocking. But of course, the audience laughed because out of pure nervousness, and of course, ultimately nobody died and nobody was really hurt. And, but this, the wife of one of the Russian producers of this theatre had a near miss, nearly lost her eye as the dagger flew out of Patterson Joseph's hand and into the audience. And then he talked about losing Tony being the major low point, but that a weird high point was watching the crew of the theatre carrying his coffin out of the church, and how this makes me cry thinking about it.
I'm not surprised it made you cry. It's unbelievably
moving. Yeah, it was just really moving, this idea of... sorry, wasn't expecting that reaction. Of the people that collaborate and make it work, and how it becomes a family, and how, you know, Tony is such a well-known figure and so extraordinary as an artist for that company, but also in our industry. And yet the family that carried his coffin were the backstage crew.
Yeah.
And he said that it was a high point because he was reminded that he had spent his life in the right place,
right,
and that Tony had they'd chosen to spend his last days in the right place, and that was, and it was really moving. It was really moving, and amazing to be back in that theatre with people that Joe and I have known for decades, and that's it's that, isn't it? It's the family of what we do. It's the collaboration, and that even though we're like ships in the night often. And you might not see someone for 20 years, 15 years, you know, you just pick up where you left off.
I think that's absolutely right. And I also think it's also a reminder, actually, of something in much lesser way that I felt about Faith Healer. That seeing Faith Healer in 1992 with my friend Bill Clancy was a life-changing event. And that sounds stupid, really, because, you know, you're just in a theatre and you're not important. I wasn't writing about the arts. I wasn't doing anything. But the capacity of a play to sum up so much of what you grapple with in life, about loss and loss of faith and belief and actually just the sheer complexity and difficulty of living and living with people.
Yeah.
It's very bottom line.
Yeah.
Which is what Faith Healer does. It is, if you have access to that, you know, and that was complete luck on my part, you know, family weren't particularly into theatre, then it does change you and you start to be able to process things that are coming into your life through that. And one of the other things I found moving this week is, slightly oddly to say that it was moving, but I did find it moving, was Keir Starmer's speech at the Guildhall about the centrality of culture in British life, in British society, and how culture should belong from the beginning to everyone.
Yeah.
It shouldn't shut out any class or any kind of person. It should just belong to everyone.
Yeah.
And why, absolutely, the bit that made me cry in that speech, which seems really odd to say that you're crying in a speech by Keir Starmer, not a man known for his emotional reach, was that he talked about his dad loving Shostakovich and playing Shostakovich.
Yeah.
And my dad's access to all culture was classical music. Yeah. And there was never any sense that he didn't feel that the whole classical musical canon belonged to him. He was a self-taught pianist and he could read music, but music was absolutely accessible to him. They went to hear, you know, his family, yeah, who didn't have much money, went to hear the Halle. He and my mom used to go and see Barbarolli. It was like a central point of life that, you know, that music belonged to everyone.
Yeah.
As did pop music and all of that, that then later came into our life. And then reluctantly he took me to the ballet and theatre, which is what I loved.
Yeah.
But I think that that central point that Starmer makes about culture being for everyone.
Yeah.
And not only being an industry, but being a life changer and a life enhancer.
Yeah.
Was so moving.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. I think he was so articulate really interesting. It's not to say that politicians and speechwriters and, you know, shouldn't go hand in hand and, you know, but it genuinely felt like it wasn't a written speech. It genuinely felt that he was standing, he was at the Guildhall, which he had a personal relationship with, that he had been a part of a youth orchestra there, you know, that he was able to say firsthand what music meant to him as a working class boy. And that, you know, getting a train from his village up to London on a Saturday to be part of this orchestra, to have people invest in you, you know, and for that to inform the rest of your life, yeah, your relationship with music and theatre and the arts, and that it shouldn't be elitist, that it is there for everyone, and that, you know, everybody has the right to choose how much of it they want in their life, wherever they come from.
Yeah.
And that's what the speech seemed to be fundamentally about. But also then what seemed incredibly honest and naked about how he felt the arts sort of fare under the Tory government, yeah, traditionally, but also in the last, however, 13 years? When has it been?
15 years.
15 years. Yeah. It felt, and it, you know, I mean, it's not hard to convince us, but it felt like it wasn't cutting and insulting in the way that sometimes political banter can get, particularly, you know, in the House, but in the House of Commons, but it just felt like this is what happens, guys. This is the evidence, and I want that to change. And I feel I want it to change because I know what access to it meant to me, and I want that for every single person in the country. And that's from education upwards.
And it is very interesting in terms of defining yourself, because one of the things I've sort of longed for Labour to do is to define itself,
yeah,
not just through the amount of money it's going to spend, because obviously there are problems about spending, but where value lies,
yeah,
and what you can do in terms of where you put value.
Yeah.
And he made the point, which is a genuine political difference, that we talk constantly about the post-war consensus and the Arts Council and the development of arts in, yeah, the post-war period from a Labour government. And it is absolutely true that the arts and culture fare better under Labour governments,
yeah,
because they believe in it more and, yeah, because they see it as a liberation and they see it as a means of expanding horizons.
Yeah.
Which is, you know, if you absolutely sort of boil a lot of what socialism is about, it, yeah, is about allowing everybody to expand their horizons and then make choices within it, you know.
Yeah.
As that thing about there's no cap on talent, there's only a cap on opportunity. And that's right, I think.
Yes, yes.
And so I think it's a really good place for Labour to have stood. But also just in a more general view, the fact, as you say, that he talked about it in such a free and sort of loving way of,
yeah,
really recognising of what, you know, the idea that culture can enhance and change life,
yeah,
as well as providing $125 billion for the economy.
Yeah, yeah.
Was a kind of really encouraging moment. And Ryan Calais Cameron, the black playwright who comes from Catford, South London.
Yeah.
Love him. And I think, you know, so, so talented. And he wrote for black boys who contemplate suicide when the hue gets too heavy, which,
yeah,
is on at the moment. Amazing play.
Yeah.
And one of the things he talked about in this Observer interview was the fact that it made an audience feel that the theatre belonged to them.
Yeah.
That they, you know, it is a different audience. And when what's extraordinary about watching it, and, you know, I do recommend it with all my heart, is that it sort of embraces you, and people kind of cry out in recognition when certain things happen. They talk, you can feel the kind of identification.
Yeah.
And it's very serious, but it's very funny, and it's part physical theatre, it's part poem, it's part sort of just event.
Yeah.
It's a fantastic thing. It's on at Soho Place now, I think.
Yeah.
And it is really just outstanding. And, you know, it's the same thing of sort of seeing that sense of culture enhancing lives and expressing feelings.
I think it's really what I think is really, really interesting, bringing up two teenagers and talking a lot about it this week. I've been around actors and, you know, actors with families, and it's always useful to connect. But the thing that I think is always true, particularly with the younger generation, is that, and people who are struggling with mental health, is that people can't hear things in the same way. You know, sometimes when you want to get through to someone to say, it's going to be all right, you're not alone, your story is valid, your voice is valid, I want to know what you think about this, I want your input to the next wave of creative productions, whether it's music or theatre or writing or whatever it is. And getting through to people and making sure that you can see that they've heard you is really, really hard sometimes, generation to generation. And I think that, I mean, he didn't necessarily say this in the speech, but it was sort of inferred that art bridges those generational gaps.
Mm.
Those stories, that music, you know, collaboration between generations sometimes makes connections for people, emotional connections, life-saving connections. And I don't mean in a romantic way. I mean, literally, you know.
Yeah.
And even doing that workshop about, you know, about the Shakespeare play, you're just reminded of the fact that generation to generation is often different languages. It's different terminology. It's different. It's just a different prism. And there isn't anything else that does that.
Yeah, and it's also true that arts is very good at responding to change.
Yeah.
And it's got that lightness on its feet, which brings me very neatly to other thing you've been doing this week, which is you've been working on an audio drama.
Yeah, so it's
an audio drama is something that has massively changed. I'm quite a fan of audio drama.
Yeah.
Though there is, there are some audio dramas that I fly across the room to turn off because I feel that they're too big for the radio.
Yeah.
But I love listening to audiobooks, and I love some audio drama. I think it's an amazing tradition. I think there's so much good writing has come up through audio drama, and so many adaptations. It's a way into things So what have you been up to? Perhaps, I don't know how much you can...
Well, it's been really, really interesting. We are doing a version of a Ford Madox Ford story called The Good Soldier. And it's one of a series of books that has been adapted by a company that make these audio dramas that he feels are very specifically and intentionally different to BBC radio drama.
Okay.
And it's very interesting trying to understand what that taste is. And it's different, but it's also fascinating, and it's, you know, a lesson in taking notes and changing your voice. I mean, I love radio for all of that, in as much as making yourself, you know, working towards a specificity that is through the eyes of somebody else, you know, the writer, the director, the producer, the, you know, the platform that you're working for.
And having to do it all with your voice, not with anything else.
Exactly. Yeah. So, and I love it for that. The sort of haiku element of it, and you know, the, sort of learning somebody else's language in order to create what they want. And it is interesting, the nature of podcasting and, you know, making audio dramas, audio books, you know, all these different terms that fly around, but that they're easier in our technical age to create.
Yeah.
And so the world of it is massive and fascinating.
Yeah. I think that it's, again, one of the things that I don't think, you know, if a historian at the start of the 20th century had been asked to predict where we would be at the sort of 24 years into the 21st century, I don't think they would necessarily forecast the boom in audio.
Yeah.
And it is a fascinating thing that somehow people love voice. I mean, I remember when I started as a journalist, in fact, writing pieces that were the exact opposite of a boom in audio. They were all about how, you know, BBC radio would die and that there wouldn't be any, you know, that everybody would be watching all the time. And of course, what you realise is it's wonderful to listen because you can listen while you're running and you can listen while you're walking and you can listen while you're cleaning the kitchen and you can listen while you're doing other things. Whereas if you're watching, you can't do that. And I do think, obviously I'm a fan of podcasts because we're making one, but I also find that you can match your mood to what you're doing. So, like, I felt that on Monday morning, the only thing I could do was listen to a football podcast. So I listened to The Rest is Football.
Yeah.
And, you know, and celebrated the fact that Manchester United had managed to beat Liverpool in the company of Gary Lineker and Micah Richards and Alan Shearer. That was the only thing I wanted. So I turned off BBC Radio 4. At another point in the day, I might feel I just want to listen to a BBC radio drama and I will put on a BBC radio drama. I'm very fond of Paul Temple, made in the 50s.
Yes,
And that kind of old-fashioned sound effects. And then something like what you're doing now, that I'm conscious there is more and more of sort of drama that is being made for audio that isn't quite the radio for. It's a really interesting thing. And podcasts, which are a different discourse of opinion and talking, again, are different. They're totally different than what we, you know, grew up with on the radio, whether it's commercial radio or BBC, really.
Well, it's interesting, isn't it? I suppose maybe there's a human endeavour or a human search for a forum in which you can make your voice heard, and that perhaps, you know, it's no criticism of the BBC, but you know, the nature of production companies and the costs involved in making work and the nature of the way things are cast and all the rest of it. I remember reading years ago Ken Branagh's book, about the beginning of his career, and he talked about when he first started and he first left RADA as compared to when he was writing the book or when the book was published. He felt that at that time, work was prolific. You know, things were being made left, right and centre, and there was experimentation. And I think that we have gone through various phases, but that maybe things have shifted slightly. I don't know. It changes all the time. And my opinion of what's going on changes all the time, according to whether I'm working or not working. You know, in all honesty.
To say that, but that's the same.
I know, it's dreadful. Oh, I've got a job. It's all marvellous.
Every freelance, that's the frightened freelance. It's absolutely consistent across all industries.
Yeah. But it's interesting that, and I haven't entirely thought this through, which is probably very clear from the way I'm waffling, but there is something about the need to express opinion, the need for real debate, that we seem to have found in this podcasting, self-publicising podcast technical forum that has grown in the last decade, that if it existed somewhere else before, it's not allowed there currently, and so we've had to shift.
Yeah.
Does that make any
sense?
Yeah,
no, I think that's it. Well, I think it's to do. So I think it's to do with the partly to do, with a shift in journalistic notions of objectivity.
Right, okay.
So when I started out as a journalist...
That's the posh way of saying what I... I'm just
whiffing. Maybe not. So when I started out in... not that long ago, really, but the whole idea was that, you know, it was sort of Woodward and Bernstein, really. Woodward and Bernstein were the gods of journalism because not only had they uncovered stories, but they had done so in ways that were, they had presented the news, and the Washington Post then presenting news in a way that was supposedly objective. In fact, it was always liberal leaning.
Yeah.
But the idea was that as much as possible, you parked your opinion to one side and you became an objective conveyor of news and information. And criticism, which I was always drawn to, was obviously not that, in the sense that that criticism relied on you presenting an opinion. But it even in that context, you were still, at some levels, your duty to history was that you tried to record what was happening as well as commenting on it.
Yeah.
What I think has increasingly happened, partly due to philosophical movements, I mean, I don't want to get too highfalutin here, but partly due to philosophical movements, which have suggested there is no such thing as truth.
Yeah.
So you know, all the sort of deconstructionists and so on, which are saying, well, you can't reach an objective truth. And partly due to politics, which has become more and more opinionated and less fact-based, is that whole discourse has been shifting for the last 20 years.
Yeah.
And effectively now we are in many ways in what, you know, is a post-truth age. The notional idea of truth as an objective you can reach.
A pivot for reality,
Is under attack.
Yeah.
And under threat. And I guess, you know, if you really look at it philosophically, that's always been the case. It's always been, you know, hard to establish the reality of the world. But now more than ever, it's not even something that people necessarily aspire to. And I think that's why. And I think part of what podcasting springs out of, and part of what actually a lot of new writing is springing out of, is that recognition that in the sort of midst of that, there is a good thing, which is to be able to acknowledge your, you know, where you're coming from, but also then to talk freely in an attempt to reach an opinion. And the bad side of the post-truth world is that everything is up for grabs.
Yeah.
You know, everything is unreal, you know, and that is, so I think it's, we're sitting at quite an interesting moment of history, at some levels.
I suppose it's a bit like the Roaring Twenties, isn't it? In as much as, you know, after the First World War, the world was in shock, and the loss of life, and also the very abrupt end to that sort of Victorian class structure, distinction. You know, that people had seen things they didn't think they'd ever experience, and but that out of that, out of poverty and debris and loss of life and loss of psychological, philosophical foundations came this regrowth, and also the youth feeling that suddenly that all bets were off.
And
there is, it feels like there are similarities in that way.
I think there is, but I think it goes back to your point that the art and arts, and one reason a society should always value the arts, is arts is the best place to try and have these conversations, because they do all the time. You know, if you think about how we learn historically, a lot of what we learn historically is from looking back at how the artists of the past have responded to events around them. And I think, you know, in a post-truth world, the importance of art saying, hang on a minute, let's just talk about these things. Becomes more and more needed.
And
that, if I was being political, sort of drawing to close, if I was being political, I think that is why every authoritarian regime distrusts the arts.
Yes.
Because the arts is a place that you actually create a space for proper debate.
Yeah.
And if authority doesn't like that, it takes us back to a mirror where the idea of, you know, art becomes dissent, essentially. And it, even if it's just discussion, it becomes dissent. And there is, you know, so to go back to Labour, Labour did have this vision that in giving everybody more tools to talk, you might produce a better world. And that's, you know, that is up for debate now, because as Starmer again said, all great inventions come from somebody who is creative, not somebody who has just learned the formula. So anyhow, this has taken us quite a long way from what I imagined this podcast
would
be about, which was going to be about audio drama, but it was, I think, quite a lovely conversation to have. Proof of the joys of podcasting. So, but it is a moment to bring it to a close. And I would say it's just time to say goodbye from me, Sarah Crompton, the critic.
And goodbye from me, Nancy Carroll, the actress.